The following program is rated M16+. Parental guidance recommended. It contains strong themed topics, drug use, alcohol use, violence and self-harm.
Welcome to Bounce Back. My name's Yvonne Fletcher from NY Events and you're listening to DRN1. Bounce Back's a fun talkback show. And today I have international comedian James Nikise. Did I say it right?
You did. Nailed it.
Yay!
Nailed it.
I have been practicing, thanks to you.
It's funny, I feel like I'm international, but I've been trapped in Perth for so long now. I'm really, my local references. I had a couple of cops in a comedy show the other night who were from like Armadale, which is where I've been staying. And they were like, oh man, your jokes about Armadale were like bang on. And I was like, yeah, I have been there too long.
You're just a local now.
Yeah, well, I mean, Armadale is full of Maori and Pacific Islanders, and I'm a Pacific Islander from New Zealand, so I'm at the local fitness centre just being like, hey, uncle.
Oh, I love actually Armadale Shopping Centre. They've done some amazing things there.
Yeah.
A really cool park close by.
To be honest, when you're a Kiwi and you're slightly homesick, being in a moor full of Maori and Pacific Islanders, it feels good.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah.
It's actually, I don't mind Armadale Shops. It's very cool. So
yeah, it's not too different to Auckland.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. I didn't know that. So anyone that wants that experience, you know, that travel experience right now, head to Armadale for the Auckland experience.
Yeah. It's just highways and moors and roadworks. That's Auckland in a nutshell.
We don't need the borders to open. No. James, thank you so much for joining me. I've got lots of questions to ask you. Cool. And so you are originally from New Zealand?
Yes.
Yeah. And when did you start your comedy journey?
I was in uni and I was dropping out of law and I wasn't dropping out of law, but I wasn't enjoying law. And a friend of mine was doing comedy and said, oh, why don't you come down to the local comedy club? And there was a bit of a clique back then of Wellington comedians. I went to university in Wellington and the headline act that night was Flight of the Conchords. And I was on doing a rookie spot. And it just kind of clicked for me. And within the next month, I dropped out of law, taking up – I wasn't allowed to drop out of uni.
Yeah.
I'd still get a degree of some kind. It's very important to my family. So I switched to theater and film, which was handy because we were making Lord of the Rings at the time. So I got work on Lord of the Rings as a day job. Like That sounds more impressive than he is because everyone in Wellington, like Jackson, paid well. It was a good job.
Yeah.
And so I just suddenly went into the arts that way. We didn't have the arts at the high school I went to.
It was your first exposure when you're in uni, no prior.
Pretty much. I'd done like a holiday workshop at this thing called the National Youth Drama School when I was 16. And it was so, like my mom had sent me there to just kind of keep me away from the young thugs and that I was hanging out with. Like the school I went to was very, I don't know what the Australian term is, it's low decile, so it was quite poor.
Okay.
Very heavy Maori and Pacific Island. A lot of rugby teams. I always say we had 450 students and 20 rugby teams.
Wow.
And no drama. We didn't do plays. We did barbershop.
What's barbershop, sorry?
Barbershop's four-part harmony singing.
Yep.
So like boys to men.
Yeah.
Who were big in the 90s, so that was very on brand. And we didn't like do musicals. We didn't really interact with the girls' colleges, which I do think, looking back, is a mistake because you can tell at university the guys who have gone to all boys schools because they're just like staring. Just
oh
just
my
like,
gosh!
They're like, oh my god, there's women. They're here. They're here. Oh, they're looking at us. What do we do? What do we do?
I've got such a strong opinion about single-sex schools, and I probably shouldn't share it on here, but I will, because I've got three boys, and I've always said that in the real world, coexisting and co-school and education is probably better because when you go into a workforce, it is much better if you don't do that staring thing.
Yeah, and like, I understand, you know, I understand where it comes from in terms of like focus, you're going to get distracted, you know, hormones. And we got a high teenage pregnancy rate where I'm from, so it didn't really work because our sister school had the largest amount of teenage pregnancy in the Wellington region and my school was heavily responsible for that. So you know, it's like I was at a wedding in January after I'd graduated. My best mate at high school, he was real smart, and he got his missus pregnant and ended up having to change his uni degree. And we got a Catholic high school, so we got them married in January. And that was also a mistake because, you know, it's a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old getting married.
Yeah.
Having a kid and thinking they're doing the right thing, but just no life experience.
Yeah.
And a lot of support around them, but, you know, that stuff was hard. So comedy was new to New Zealand.
Yep.
We've got a younger scene than Australia. So when I started, the most common question to comedians was, oh, what's your day job?
Mm.
And not in a, oh, because, you know, there's no, there was an understanding that there's no comedy scene in New Zealand back then. This is the early 2000s I'm talking about. And so it started off as a novelty. And then within a few years, it kind of became serious. I was doing TV spots and sort of getting nominated and winning some awards and that. And then the opportunity came to go overseas to the UK. And both my parents are immigrants. My mum is from Wales. And I didn't really know that kind of side of my family. And I was very discombobulated. I think a lot of mixed race kids, when we're growing up, it takes us a little bit longer to have our sense of our self-identity.
Yeah.
Because we're dealing with, especially if your parents are immigrants, you got three cultures. You got your mum's culture, your dad's culture, and then the culture of the country that you're in. So you got to find where you sit within those, at the very minimum, three cultures. Some people have even more.
Yeah.
And I didn't know, this is, again, early 2000s, you know, we don't have Skype, we don't really have Facebook or Messenger, or like the communication is emails and MSN at best, you know. Cell phones, you only do text, you can't send pictures. The world is much larger.
Yeah, I think we had MySpace back then, didn't we?
Yeah. MySpace and so...
Bug bitten, I think, as well. Yeah, that was
that's like younger listeners are going, what? Biggest terms. So I didn't know that side of my family, the British side, and I went over there, and that was really important because not only was I exposed to a proper full time, the largest live comedy scene in the world, which kicked me in the teeth a few times, but was, you know, the way it really helped me grow. But I also met my British family, and I realized I wasn't a weird Samoan New Zealander.
Yeah.
Even by Samoan New Zealander standards, I was pretty weird. I was a British Samoan New Zealander.
Yeah, okay.
Because I met all my UK family.
So it kind of brought it all together for you.
My Samoan family are church ministers and lawyers, accountants. Some are, you know, a lot of them are construction and youth worker, but they're all quite, none of them are really, they're all artistically gifted. But not artistically inclined.
Okay, yep.
My British family were all artsy, writers, musicians, even if they were youth workers, youth theatre, dance.
Wow.
And I was like, oh man, that's where this comes from. Like, I've got artistic talent on my Pacific side, but the passion and the idea of going into it as a career is from this side. And that kind of gave me the confidence to come back.
That's a really nice story, actually. And, yeah, to find your path that way as well. And a bit of your identity, I guess, is in who are you and where do you come from?
I mean, and that was the first building blocks of my identity was that first trip to the UK and doing Edinburgh and doing gigs in London and understanding how big the world is. Because I think a bit like Perth, New Zealand has a very isolated mentality, maybe not consciously, but simply just geographically, we are, and Perth is an island.
Yeah. So,
you know,
surrounded with a desert and the ocean.
Yeah. And there is a certain mentality you have about leaving and about staying and about coming back.
Yeah.
And I had to really go back and forth between the UK and New Zealand quite a bit. Before I sort of began to understand that part of my identity was also the missing part was a traveler. I'm very much someone who travels, and not in a pretentious way of I want to see the world and all that, but I'm descendant from Pacific people, from the greatest navigational voyages in the history of the world. And so there is that part of me that wants to explore and wants to meet new people and you know, see the similarities between cultures, which is part of the joy of what comedy allows you to do, is to go to a new place and meet people and make fun of them.
I think as well, when you do travel, it opens you up to universally, when I say universally worldwide, there are similarities with different things. I just remember when I went to Hong Kong, the similarity I found with like five different nations, randomly met these people, it was with Tinder. And it was an interesting, so seriously funny story from each like five different places in the world. So I think sometimes you do find that commonality, and it's so good.
When you used to travel and you didn't have Tinder? You just got to rely on like a mate to take you to a place where there's other of their mates? And you're like, okay.
I actually love when you travel by yourself, because I think you open up to meeting new people so much more and, yeah, have those experiences just come to you, which is, yeah, it's great. So comedy, you went to the, you know, UK. And then how did you end up here in Perth?
That's actually a very interesting story, because I'd never done a solo show overseas, not even in the UK. So I cut my teeth becoming a club comic in the UK and working up to a high level there. And then I'd moved back to New Zealand, chasing a woman who'd broken up with me. And that hadn't worked out, but that was a good growing point. In life, in my mid-20s, I believe it's known in modern times as your late 20s quarter life crisis or something like that. And I was also beginning to take my first steps into the world of theater, because even though I had a theater degree, I didn't really act. I'd done stand-up for the majority of my 20s, and I wrote a show that wasn't funny. I couldn't figure out why it wasn't funny, because it was about my parents' domestic violence. And I was like, surely this is funny. It's not.
Okay.
But I showed it to a friend of mine, and they were like, oh, I think you've written a play.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
I went, oh, are you sure? Because this is definitely a stand-up show. And I went, yeah, but that's because you've written it for you to speak. Like, just turn it all into characters and separate it. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, I had my first play. And I also met an actor and a playwright who I fell in love with and decided to stay in New Zealand and try and build something there. Fast forward a couple of years, and suddenly me and this woman are in a puppet show of Pulp Fiction, the movie, called Puppet Fiction.
Oh, cool.
And these people from Perth were on a grant, arts grant, to come to New Zealand, and they came through Wellington, and they saw us performing our crazy marionette puppet show, and we got talking and hung out, and she had a solo play, and I had a solo comedy show, and they said, well, what if you guys came to Perth and did the Perth Fringe? And we were like, what's the Perth Fringe? How long does it take to get to Perth? Because in my mind, and this can shock people who aren't from Perth, Kiwis don't know how to do distance when it comes to Australia.
Don't think anyone in the world does.
I feel like we were like, oh, it's Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, Perth. But like every one of those places is a 1 hour flight.
Yeah, yeah.
So showed up in Perth and was like, hey, what's this thing going on outside? And they were like, oh, that's the 40 degree heat. And I was like, okay, well, that doesn't happen in New Zealand. When does it stop? And they're like, oh no, this is for the whole festival. It's like, okay, I'm going to need to buy shorts. then I did my solo show, which was on New Zealand gangs and growing up and all of that stuff. And it sold out, and I got nominated for the Comedy Award. And I think a lot of people were nominated for the Perth Comedy Award. But for me, that was a big deal, because I'd had this narrative back in New Zealand, and I don't know, again, if it's the same here in Perth, that, oh, you're a New Zealand Pacific Islander, you know, sure, you're British, but you probably do British jokes in the UK, and your stuff won't work overseas, and if you take one of your solo shows about New Zealand overseas, it's not going to work, so you might as well stay home
Oh, okay. And that was what you were telling yourself.
Well, yeah, because that was the narrative being fed to me by the people in the career pathways above me, television producers theatre directors. They're like, oh, your stuff won't work overseas. When I came overseas here to Perth and I'm selling out and people were coming, I was like, oh, hang on a second.
Polar opposite.
And I felt like an idiot because 6 years of my life had passed.
Oh, no.
And I'd never taken a solo show. And I realized that I just listened to these people. I'd never questioned it.
Yeah.
I'd never tried because I'd allowed them to convince me. And as soon as I came here, that's why I've always had a soft spot for Perth, because it was another part of my identity that was opened up about being a traveler.
Yeah.
I could work as a traveler. It wasn't just a luxury. It could be the job.
Yeah. How awesome is that as well?
That's how I ended up in Perth. My wife tells me that's also when we met. But I was drinking at the time I wasn't good. I wasn't at my best. I have no memory of meeting her. And she says it's probably for the best because I was quite patronizing. considering like how renowned she is in Australia as a comedian, I'm quite embarrassed just thinking about that. We met many years later in Melbourne.
Yeah,
And she had the good grace to not remind me about it.
She must have liked you, James.
I think so. I think she bless her. She saw me do a comedy set and thought that's a guy I'd like to talk to and get to know. And then she talked to me and went, "I no, he's not ready." And, but then we many years later, I was single and she was single, and we were both in Melbourne. And I asked her out for a coffee as a mate, and she showed up as a mate. And then we went for coffee the next day as well, because we both had gigs. And I'm like, oh, that was fun. Let's do it again tomorrow. And then we did it again. And then we went to the museum on the fourth day. And then we just didn't stop hanging out. And then we got married. So that's.
And she's beautiful. Like. Yeah, you guys are really cute together.
It's funny because no one in New Zealand knew about Laura.
Yeah, wow.
And so,
what did you guys do? Just update your Facebook status?
Yeah, literally. I put up a photo and said, Talofa, Samoan family, I just wanted you to meet your new family member. Now, the funny thing about that is my dad eloped with my mum.
Oh, wow.
So he went overseas to finish his PhD. He came to Canberra to finish his PhD at the University of Canberra there. And part of his PhD meant he had to travel around the Pacific to the other universities. And he met my mum. She was a librarian on her gap year from the UK in the library of Port Moresby University with her first husband. And they hooked up and eloped. So there's this precedent in my family. So 30 years later, I put a Facebook update to all my non-Samoan friends were like, oh my God, who is this lady? Oh my God. All my Samoan family were like, bah, does your dad know? Bah.
History repeating itself.
Yeah, they gave him so much crap. It was really funny.
Oh, how long have you and Laura been together now?
Good question. Strong question. about 4 years.
Yeah.
About 4 years. 4 years since it's gone, did our first date.
Yeah. It's. Do you feel as well since all this COVID stuff? Time's a bit skewy in my head, and I don't know if it's my age or if it's COVID.
No, I've got a friend who's like, look, I don't care what the date says, it's still 2020. And
yeah,
I
was good.
Like,
yeah,
that's fair.
I like your
that's
friend.
Absolutely fair.
Yeah.
Like, and I talk about last year, and I'm talking about this year.
Yeah.
Because my years are now defined by when a lockdown happens. Yeah. So I'm like, remember last year when I did that show? And they went, you mean May? And I'm like, yes, sorry, May.
It's froze you, doesn't it? Just mentally.
Totally.
Yeah. And we haven't really had it bad here in Perth. It's been pretty.
Yeah. Look, I'm regarded in New Zealand as the kiss of death because I left the UK and they had their breakout and I got stuck in New Zealand but avoided a lockdown. I left New Zealand and they had a breakout and I got stuck in Perth but avoided a lockdown. So Mark McGow has actually got in touch with me and he said, can you just let my department know when you're flying out of Perth so we can prepare to lock down?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably coming faster than what we realise. So, us opening our borders, I think, is going to be here soon.
Well, there's attention. You know, my comedy show I did this year was a very new... It's the first time I've done it in a long time. I wrote a show for New Zealand.
Yeah.
Specifically for New Zealand, because I didn't know if I'd be able to tour. And it was like a love letter, but it was also about trauma.
Yeah.
It was called Let It Go, and it was about the tension that was sitting underneath, because Kiwis, I don't know if Western Australians are the same, but Kiwis were very emotionally stunted unless it's sport or drunk.
Yep.
So we don't let it out, and we all had this tightness about us because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing to be isolated, it's another thing to be isolated and not be able to leave the isolation.
Yeah. Yeah, James, I've really mentally struggled myself. And as I've said, we didn't have it very bad here. But I'm a real people person. Yeah. So to say to me, and at the time I was a single mom and, you know, doing all that sort of stuff, I was like, oh my gosh, what do you mean I can't see my friends?
Yeah.
That was really confronting. And then I really worried about our elderly who all of a sudden, you know, had these beautiful outings they used to do and socialize. And then they were told, you can't see your friends and you can't go on these outings anymore. Yeah. It's hard. I think the whole world has suffered through that.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's like we've lost people in my family.
Sorry about that.
But we haven't lost them to COVID. We've lost them to other things.
Mm.
But we can't see them because of COVID. So in many ways, it's still because of COVID.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, you know, I was just about to get on a plane to Perth, and my auntie in Edinburgh, who did the flowers and the cake for our wedding, died.
And
then I landed, and my Samoan auntie in New Zealand, who was one of the last conversations we had, was her meeting Laura, and go, oh, you're so beautiful, and you ate the fried chicken, it's a beautiful memory. I landed here, and a week later, she died. But they were also closing the borders.
I'm sorry about your loss, James. That's really hard when you can't breathe them properly.
Exactly. And what I've said is that, you know, I'm even talking about this now, I feel it coming in, the grief.
Mm. Yeah.
But I'm quite good at, like, not dealing with grief, but learning to give grief perspective.
Yeah.
So there's a part of me that knows I will not stop grieving for my auntie in Edinburgh until I finally return to Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Because that's where the grief is.
Yeah.
And with my Samoan auntie in New Zealand, I won't be able to properly grieve for her till I return to Wellington, because that's where that grief is. And it doesn't kind of matter how I feel about it here.
Yeah.
It's still, I need to be where the memories are.
Yeah.
So I can let them wash over me and kind of wash out.
Yeah. I always say grief is like the ocean. You let it wash in and then you let it wash out.
Absolutely.
And it comes in waves as well. You never know when it's going to hit.
No. And I think one of the wonderful things about being married to an artist is that is very much, that kind of language can sound very airy-fairy if you're not in the arts. But part of the arts is letting emotions run through you, because often you're either portraying someone else or you're telling a story where you and you're putting emotions into other people as you convey. So when you're married to someone who's also in the arts, or someone who knows the arts well, you know, it allows you to be open, and you can say to your partner, hey, I'm having a day.
Yeah.
I'm feeling this. You know, I'm thinking about that person. And they know exactly what I mean. Like, well, what do you mean you're thinking about that? Why are you thinking about it? Well, don't think about it. You know, you can actually have – and I think openness, you know, when you meet someone, part of the reason you know you're going to be in a relationship, I think, with them is openness and safety.
Yeah, being vulnerable with someone.
Yeah.
I love when you've got that special person, and you can feel safe with them, and it's okay to feel, you know, that sad and that grief, and them to hold space with you. That's a very special relationship.
And vulnerability is so important, because part of where I think we get into trouble, where we have these massive outbursts, is we keep things tight and we keep things locked in. I've learned that the hard way, and one of the things I try and do with my male friends, because they've seen my work and whatnot, but also just the way the world is, and we come from the staunchest rugby nation in the world, mate, where you just gotta play the game.
Yeah.
We try and tell each other we love each other.
Yeah.
You know,
I tell all my friends I love them. I mean, healthy.
But it's, I think it's harder for men.
Yeah.
And harder for straight men as well.
Yeah.
Because I think for respectfully, and I apologize if I'm speaking out of place for the community, but I think for gay men, there's a power in using that emotional language because they weren't able to for so long.
Yeah.
It makes them feel empowered to be able to do that as well. And I think for straight men, because of the toxicity that exists in masculinity, just those little viruses in our computer program of masculinity, it's hard because we still associate vulnerability with weakness.
Yeah.
And we feel weakness is bad.
Yeah.
We don't understand that weakness is human. And
it is human,
natural,
isn't it? Yeah.
And weakness can lead to growth.
Yeah. So true, James. You know, with love as well, I think one of the things I always say to people, because all my friends say to me, you know, you're the one that's made saying I love you not weird in our friend group. Yeah. And I think saying you love someone is not saying I'm in love with you. Mm. You're saying you love them as a person. And I think that's really, it's bonding, it's beautiful. It's okay to love our friends just like we love our family. And
the funny thing we found in... is we can say it not in English, real easy.
Can
you? We say it in the Māori language, we go, aroha nui. And that's I love you. And we can say it, we roll off the tongue in the Māori language. Or for Samoans, we'll go, aloha tele. And we'll say, see you later. Well, yep, aloha, yep, cool.
I love that. Thanks for sharing the language. It's beautiful.
But if you say it in English, be like, see you later, bro. I love you, bro. They're like, oh, what did you say that? You know, it's so funny because it's so natural for us to say it in our indigenous languages.
Yeah.
But as soon as English becomes involved, it's almost like...
Why do you think it shifts?
I think to a degree it's the vulnerability of when we're talking in Māori or we're talking in Samoan, you know, that's not something everyone can hear.
Okay.
They don't know what we're saying, but English is the universal language.
Yeah.
So we say, oh, no, someone else might hear. So again, it's that it's okay for us to say. And, you know, like give each other a big hug.
Yeah.
Feel okay to cry in front of each other. You know?
Yeah.
And this isn't something men want to do this.
Yeah. And they should. They should be allowed to do it and give themselves permission to do it. Yeah. But I get that it must be really hard because there is a generational thing, I feel, and there's been, you know, these perceived ideas.
Yeah. And I think my generation, which is the guys now who are in their early 40s to late 20s, we're the ones who are really doing, you know, you watch the guys in their young 20s, you know, young mid-20s, they're hip to it. They know
what
they're doing. Watch the guys mid-40s up, it's a bit more tense. yeah. And I think my generation's the one that's just kind of, we're trying to normalize it.
Yeah.
Because you can see, like, men want to share, want to cry, and are fine doing it in private.
Yeah.
They still feel that's for me, that's not... for anyone else, and that's the toxicity, because that's what bottling it up chokes people. Like,
And it is suffocating, James. It's probably a good lead into what you've done. You've done a lot of mental health stuff,
yes.
And you've got an amazing podcast which you shared with me last time we caught up at a gig. And eating fried chicken, right?
Yeah, eating fried chicken in the shower.
How did it start? And
well, years ago, it seems like years ago, there's no easy way to go into this, so I'll just put a trigger warning. I'm going to talk about suicide for the listeners there. But I had my second suicide attempt a few years ago coming back to New Zealand. I walked in front of a bus.
Oh, my God.
To the airport.
Yeah.
Very, very strange and very surreal. The whole trip back to New Zealand was very surreal. I had a friend, a very dear friend of mine, who I started comedy with way back in the day, and now he works in another job. But we went for lunch when I got back, because I reached out to him. I said, look, this has happened. He said, that's all right, man. Get home, get settled. And he took me out for lunch, and he said, look, I don't want you to go back to your family tonight. I said, well, how come? He said, look, just my missus is away for the week. Come stay at us. Sleep on the couch, play Xbox, hang out.
Yep.
Just hang out. But don't put this one on your family. And I didn't know I still don't know what he saw. He'll describe it. He just said there was
a weight. He's had something, a feeling.
He said there was a weight on you.
Wow.
That's how he puts it. Not in some mystical kind of way. He just, my face, my muscles, whatever was happening,
yeah.
I looked strained.
Yeah.
And so he came and, you know, it took a few days. And then I just really had a good cry. And then we went and got KFC. And we got back. And I said, oh, man, I'm all greasy and wet from crying. I'm just going to go have a shower. He said, well, you going to finish that chicken? And I took the popcorn chicken to the shower, and I sat in the shower eating popcorn chicken, and I felt so good afterwards. And it just became this running joke about me having, remember when you had your breakdown and end up eating fried chicken in the shower? And I was like, yeah, bro.
Probably washed all the grease away, right?
Totally, very, very cleansing. And then I was catching up with a friend of mine who's a producer, and because he's also a friend, and he'd heard, word had got round at this point. And we went for a coffee, and I told him about it, and he emailed me later that night and said, hey, look, man, how would you feel talking about this kind of stuff? I said, oh, I don't know. He said, I think I might have something. Can I send you a pitch tomorrow? And he wrote something up, and it looked good to me. And we pitched it to Radio New Zealand, which is our version of the ABC.
Yeah.
And they came back and said, yeah, we're going to fund this because we're not sure if it'll work, but we have to fund a show called Eating Fried Chicken in the Shower. And four seasons later, we've done a whole bunch of interviews with a whole bunch of people, some famous, some not so famous, but all doing interesting mental health journeys. The whole idea is just to normalize talk about different mental health situations.
Mm.
And they all come in, and we use the All Blacks shower.
Yeah.
Because that's the way New Zealand works. The All Blacks are like, well, we got a shower. You want to use our shower? And then we sit in there, we eat whatever chicken they want, and it's been really fulfilling to be able to. I don't normally talk this much in an interview. I usually just let them talk and I just sit there eating away. But it's very nice to have had such a traumatic moment and be able to look back and go, well, from that came this wonderful thing. And I'm glad you like it because I do get messages from people.
Yeah. I love that you're making a difference for men in mental health because, yeah, there's...
Do you know what it is?
It's needed.
When they asked me what kind of show I wanted to make, I said to them, I want to make a show that is a resource for young people that I wish I had when I was in my early 20s trying to figure stuff out.
Yeah.
You know, I wish I'd if it didn't give me the answers, I wish I'd at least had a starting point.
Yeah.
Where I could have gone. Because we never try and solve people's problems in my show.
No.
We just let people say what their journeys are. And then I do these follow-up episodes with this clinical psychologist who's a friend of mine. And we don't diagnose anyone either. I just go to him with questions I think a listener will want to go. And then we just make sure we provide resources for people to be able, if, you know, you've listened to this episode.
That's a great follow-up.
Yeah.
Terrific.
That's you know, we just want to do some care. So if people come in and we've opened them up and they're going, oh, man, I do have these issues. Oh, I need to see something. Then we can go, oh, cool. Well, you can get in contact with these people or these people. And that's been, it's been really fulfilling.
James, with that, was your pivotal moment of change your friend grabbing you in that moment and saying, hey, stay with me? And was that sort of a shift for you?
I think, no, I think what the pivotal moment for me was actually a year later when I started making a stand-up show.
Mm-hmm.
So I my first suicide attempt had been much more dramatic. And when I started making a show about both attempts to contextualize them, I realized that they were very different. And an understanding that they were both different. The first one involved cutting and booze and drugs. And the second one was numbness and burnout.
Okay.
And an understanding that my brain, you know, people think of suicide, there's just one pathway and then you get there.
Yeah, and there's not.
And
yeah.
It's not. And I think understanding that there are different ways that could get there allowed me to think about it more three-dimensional.
Yeah.
And understand a bit like I'm an alcoholic, I'm diagnosed now, and that's helped a lot.
Yeah.
Because it's helped me understand addiction and mental pathways.
Okay.
And to be conscious that when we talk about mental health, it's not a period of your life. Your brain is a muscle, like any other part of your body. So mental fitness,
yeah,
you know, mental care is the same as drinking green tea or like having yeah. a smoothie. And it's just understanding that you don't take your brain for granted.
Yeah.
And like any exercise, it's going to suck at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then it's going to become just a bit more normal and a bit more natural.
Yeah.
And I think that's what any work I've tried to do on mental health, I've always just tried to normalize it.
Yeah. I think the more we talk about it as well, the more it does become normal and the more people feel safe going, hey, I need help, or I'm going through this. And that's why I like to talk about it very openly. So yeah.
And you know what? The great thing is, you know, I know a lot of people talk about cancel culture and wokeness and all that, but all of that's really the sideshow to the bigger conversation that we're all having, is that we are all feeling crap.
Yeah.
There's something in society that's making us all feel in different ways crap. And in some ways we're lashing out here or lashing out there, or we're feeling depressed or anxious. So many more people are feeling anxious. Mm. And I think part of how we go forward, first of all, we feel comfortable saying to each other, hey, I am feeling vulnerable, weak, scared. And that's okay. That's human. That's normal. And then we work from there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I hear you. When I went through my own journey myself, my sister always said to me, you know, I thought we had lost you because I wasn't verbalizing stuff. Mm. And I had just made it, you know, I just wanted out basically. And I feel that, you know, I felt like I was a burden to everyone.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I've had to go on my own journey and learn to communicate better and be vulnerable. That's hard for me to just open up and go, hey, how I'm feeling. And I know that, you know, that might be more typically a male thing to not be able to be vulnerable. But I was always, you know, the oldest child, I have to be strong, have to be this, you know, but learning that you don't have to be anything and it's okay just to sit wherever you are feeling as well.
Yeah, and also, when I say it's the male thing, it's because I'm a male.
Mm.
So you know, I
yeah, you can identify.
I can identify. I might be completely wrong.
No, I don't think so. Yeah,
I'm speaking from I'm a straight male guy, and I'm speaking from that experience.
Mm.
And one of the other things I try and say to my other straight male friends is, one, you can only speak from your experience, but it's good to hear other people's experiences.
Yeah.
Because what, you know, it might be different from yours, but you're also going to find some points of empathy.
Yeah.
And you're going to realize, actually, okay, I feel like this, and you feel like that, and I think there might be something here.
Yeah, some collaboration. And
yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think that anyone's experience is wrong. I just think it's different. Yeah. And I think the more that we start to accept that we're all different, and that's okay.
Mm.
Just we've lived things differently and we've taken on board different stories and different journeys, and just be open to hearing those differences.
Yeah. And I think in doing that, that's where you find the power of community.
Mm.
And I think there's the nature of technology is that it has at once made us more open to a global community, but it's also isolated us to our thumbs.
Yes, so yeah. True. We don't make eye contact as much, do we?
No. And sometimes you're talking and you're listening to someone because your ear is facing them, but your eyes and your phone are synced up there. And they're like, are they listening? Like, no, I'm listening to you, but my...
Yeah, you can feel that lack of connection or disconnection, can't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is sad because growing up in Perth, I used to always walk, and I still do it. I can't help myself. But I walk down the street. I actually purposely try to eye engage with someone and smile at them. And then people can't help but smile back.
Yeah.
But you go to the bigger cities, there's no way that happens. When I lived in Sydney, there's no way people thought I was weird because I'd been trying to make eye contact with them and smile and engage, you know.
Because I do that where I'm staying at the moment, but that's because I'm in a very small part of Perth.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I got two options here. I can make no eye contact. I'm just going to look like the shifty dude who's only just showed up in the past couple of months. Or I can smile and say, hey, how's it going? And they go, oh, hey, hello.
Yeah.
You know, and just be, hey, I'm friendly foreigner. I'm like, yes, you haven't seen me before, but I am not a threat. Hello. And it's, I think I always tell Kiwis, get out of the country when you can. Don't have to stay out of the country.
Yeah.
Get out. Broaden your horizons. Meet people. See their situations. I've been, being in comedy here, I've been in green rooms and people, one thing, I make fun of it now, but, it's people trying to see what side of political spectrum I'm on.
Or in Perth.
Yeah, they'll be like, oh, so what, mate,
really?
You go left, you go right, what do you go? And I remember I was just giggling and I went, mate, I'm trying to have a serious conversation with you. And I went, bro, I can't vote. I can't vote, man. Like, why are you trying to have this?
Isn't that like apolitical? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. It's like if you just want to talk to me about something, I'm probably the safest person in this room you can talk to me about. I have no skin in this game. Not really. Not, yeah. I can tell you I care about issues and that, but if you're asking me left or right in terms of Australian politics, I can't vote. And so I think it's good for people who are getting too caught up in the anxiety levels. When you can, go to a place where you can't vote because it really gives you perspective on what actually matters to you.
Yeah. Prior to COVID, but I didn't even know who was in our political parties.
No one knew. There's never been a time on the planet when public servants have been this public.
Yeah.
Like in New Zealand, we have a director of the Department of Health. Yep. He's a bona fide celebrity. He's second to Jacinda Ardern.
Really?
He's the most plain looking man you'll ever see in his life. He sounds like this when he talks. He sounds like a Kiwi Kermit the Frog. And his name's Ashley Bloomfield, but in New Zealand you have to call him Dr. Ashley Bloomfield because you've got to call him his full title out of respect because he's a damn hero. And all he did was do like daily reports. You know the daily reports you see people do? He did those and people were like, oh, he's got a nice calming voice. Oh. And it's, again, it's understanding that that's lovely, but that's not normal.
Because it's not normal.
Because we don't live in normal times, and that's okay. I feel like I just want to grab everyone and go, guys, you feel so heightened and scared right now because it's heightened and scary times. It's your emotional state is normal.
And universally, I always say worldwide, but we're all feeling it.
Yeah.
We are all feeling the same. Yeah. And it would be great for some love to get pumped out there and for us to manifest that and build up everyone again.
Yeah. And the other thing we don't talk about is exhaustion because trying to find the emotional space, COVID and the anxiety of all of that, it takes up so much headspace that there's not very much left in your brain to cope with the other stuff. No. And that can be hard as well. I don't want to weigh into the debate at all, but the vaxxer, anti-vaxxer thing, I think part of the reason everything's got so heightened and it's been hard for people to meet and not meet in the middle because I'm vaccinated and I think people should be vaccinated. But in terms of have conversations of empathy and trying to understand why people are scared or what's made them there, people don't have the space.
No.
They don't have the mental space.
Yeah.
And I think we miss that conversation of going, hey, it's okay to not have the mental space to deal with that.
Yeah.
And it's you don't engage.
Yes. Yeah.
Because you might do more damage.
Yeah.
You might actually, if you go in yelling at someone like that because you don't have the mental capacity to approach them with empathy, you might actually push them away. And that's not what we want.
No, we don't want to divide. And we do want that space where we can say, it's okay to like different things.
Yeah.
But you're right. I think it did lack that educational process, maybe, or that discussion. Maybe the discussion is a better thing where we openly went, hey, okay, let's talk about this. And then maybe people would have,
But even then, it's because we didn't have time.
Yeah.
And I think again, it's just that openness to be able to – it's hard because governments want to appear strong. But on the other hand, you feel like if you just put up your hand and said, hey, guys, this is rushed because we're in trouble.
Yeah.
And people go, okay, right.
Yeah. And we've never lived in a time, who would have thought we would have had something like this happen in our lifetimes? Like,
And it heightens everything.
Yeah.
And so the default state for everyone is just at this nuts level. Like, do you remember when performing comedy straight out of a lockdown? You're bulletproof.
Yes.
You're bulletproof. You can't. My first few gigs out of the New Zealand lockdown, I was clunky as hell. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm getting away with this. Like, I am so rusty. Like, and they were like almost standing ovations.
Wow.
Where I would not have, like, if I'd done that set last night, they would have gone, oh yeah, he's all right. Because people needed.
I needed that, yeah, they connection
needed to
again.
Express. They needed to be amongst people. And there was a mania to being out. And every city I've seen come out of lockdown, there's been a little bit of a mania.
Yeah.
And when you talk to people who've been in lockdown for too long online, there's a little bit of a mania.
Yeah.
I feel like we aren't talking about that.
Yeah, I don't think we are either, or acknowledging it. I've seen when we came out running events, a lot of people were self-destructive almost.
Yeah.
And you had to manage that as an event person and sort of sit in their space and kind of be respectful, but try to navigate that. And that was a bit hard to begin with.
I remember I saw this guy, he's a commentator now. He was saying some wild stuff. Just kind of where, and people were kind of, where has this come from? I can't, oh, and people, oh, I'm so disappointed. Oh, I can't believe it. And people were going, oh, and I was a fan of this guy. He's an athlete. I was like, this is weird.
Yeah.
It took me 10 minutes on Google to discover his son died 6 months ago.
That's shocking. Yeah.
And you go, well, there's two things in play here. One, this dude, of course, if you're living in the pandemic and then your son dies.
Yeah.
You're not going to be in the right headspace. Two, don't put a microphone in front of this dude.
Yeah. Like, give him some time to grieve.
Where is the work mental health check that should be like going in?
Yeah. I guess the audience could hear it, like yourself, surely his producers and the people around him could have heard it and, you know, given him support as well.
And that's the thing, when you've got people going, I think as a comedian, you're always looking for the angle. And so when you hear people saying wild stuff, there is that inherent part of you that goes, I wonder what's happened.
Yeah.
Why are you doing this?
Yeah.
You know, whether it's someone like Kanye West or Dave Chappelle or like someone who's being outspoken.
Yeah.
I go, what's happened?
I like that you want to go under the surface.
I find it sad when I see people who I like really respect and that say outlandish things.
Yeah.
And like, oh man. But I'm also go, what am I not seeing?
Yeah.
I don't know you.
It's good to be curious about and good to question things.
Yeah. So
well done for doing that.
Well, no, I think that's part of like what we should do. We should do.
Yeah, pause. Pause before judgment.
Yeah, or just like breathe in there. And some people are bad.
Yeah.
That's the truth you find out. Some people are bad.
Yeah.
And you're wasting your mental health. You're draining your own mental health.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why we call them toxic relationships. But,
yeah.
But, you know, I think COVID has made it that much harder
for us.
And we were already, as a society, having mental health issues.
Definitely.
That we were trying to address.
Yeah.
Then this thing comes along.
I know. Yeah.
Like every time they say the word variant, my butt just clenches. You know? I'm like, what? What is it now? What? And you know they changed the name on the latest variant?
No, what is it now?
Because it was new.
Yeah.
And new, because that was the next letter in the Greek.
Yeah.
But then people were like people were doing like Albert and Costello. They were like, new. So is it new? No, it's called new. No, but it's the new one. Yeah, it's the new one. But it's what's it called? It's called new. And they were like, oh, well, this is stupid. And I think the next letter was like G.
Yeah.
But they were like, oh, that sounds too Chinese. We're going to like create a massive racist storm. So now they've gone with Omicron or Omicron.
Oh my gosh.
And Omicron sounds so terrifying.
It does.
But I feel like they've done it on purpose so that everyone will take it seriously. Because, you've got that's the beta variant or it's the Delta.
Yeah.
You go, oh, that's, I don't know, what's that? But Omicron sounds like the virus has come, like, sentient.
I remember when COVID first hit, I just felt so much fear in myself.
Yeah.
And I ended up just getting reckless, to be honest. I was like, well, we're all doomed. That's it. And it was crazy. It was a crazy mentality and space to go into, but that's where I went. So
my family, I had to sit them down and go, it's okay if you drink.
Because
they're like, oh, we don't want to bring booze into the house because, you know, you're an alcoholic and it's already stressful enough. I said, well, don't leave it like lying around.
Yeah.
But you need to drink. I'm going to, like, I ended up drinking kombucha, which is terrible.
I make my own. Yeah. I haven't in ages, but.
By all means, make your own. Hey, look, if kombucha's for you, we don't judge kombucha on this program. But I was like, I need something that doesn't taste like, I don't remember what beer tastes like.
Yeah. How long's it been?
5.5.
Wow.
Yeah, 5.5 years. So I don't remember what beer tastes like.
Yeah.
So I tricked my brain. It didn't make me drunk, but it was that psychosomatic calmness of drinking a vessel of Vambuca from a glass bottle.
Yeah.
And I even held it like I used to hold a beer bottle. I'm just like swigging it.
Great for your gut health.
Oh, great for my gut health. shame there was a toilet paper shortage. But, I'm like holding it, just going, oh man, what's the world coming to? And swigging my kombucha. Which I'm sure is what people in Perth think people in Melbourne do all the time. But I knew I needed, for my own mental health, I needed to drink from a glass bottle. I needed that comfort from the old days.
Yeah.
But also, I couldn't drink.
Yeah.
Because that would be an extra burden on my family.
Yeah.
If I slipped into that, And you do end up playing little mental games sometimes as an addict where you go, oh, I can't now. Even when you really want to, you go, oh, I can't. So you start going, oh, maybe after lockdown. But I can't now because I'm in lockdown and I'm with my family and that's too much to put on them. So maybe afterwards. And then when it gets to afterwards, go, oh, no, I've got to work.
So it's a delay tactic and that's worked for you?
It has. It's not perfect, but I'm usually quite good.
Yeah.
I've shifted my thinking now. It's taken a long time because addiction's a slow process to get over.
Yeah.
And I'm not over it because you're just kind of you're not on a wagon you fall off. You're just on a wheel. You're on a cycle. So I'm holding right now.
And James, the fact that you work in clubs and pubs and everything and it's around you all the time, that's very good self-control.
Well, it's learned and it's being open and honest with yourself. So I've walked into venues and I've walked out.
Okay.
And I've got my head together and then I've come back and gone straight to the green room.
Yeah.
I let every bar manager of every venue I go to know, hey, I'm an alcoholic. Yep. I don't make it a thing. I'll go up and get a Coke and just say, hey, by the way, bro, I'm an alcoholic. I'm performing tonight.
Yeah.
But just so you know, I might come and ask for a ginger ale in a small glass or just like a whiskey or something like that. Because sometimes people want to buy you a drink.
Yeah.
And you don't want to have the whole spiel.
Yeah.
But
and then they're on board with you and they can help you to get through that.
Yeah. And I also don't know how other addicts out there find it, but I find doing those little mental games is actually stimulating in its own way.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a dopamine hit from doing those little processes and negotiating it. And it's and just understanding that if I fall off the wagon, if I have a drink, then that's not the end of my sobriety.
No.
That's just the next step into being sober.
Yeah, again. You haven't failed. It's just
Because I think, again, people, they think about this stuff and if you're sober, then you're winning. And if you drink, you're failing.
Mm.
It's not that. If I drink, I'm going to harm either myself or someone else.
Yeah. James, do you think not drinking has been a positive on your mental health?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's good.
No, and it was a big part of understanding the stress fractures that it put on me. I didn't, and also understanding how natural it had become for my life. I hadn't had a year sober since I was 14.
Wow, you were a baby.
I grew up in a bogan place. I grew up in lower
but even brain developmentally, then you're so young.
So yeah, so I went through full withdrawal.
Yeah,
when I sobered up, I cold turkey accidentally because even New Zealand's mental health system isn't great.
Mm.
So they couldn't see me for a month, but I had to stop. So I cold turkeyed, which I was then told I shouldn't have done. But it took 10 days and it was horrific. But because it was horrific, it was real.
Yeah.
So it wasn't the performer in the family being overly dramatic. You know, my family watched me lie on the ground shaking with cold sweats. They saw my face in the morning. My partner at the time had to go stay with friends because the bed sheets were soaked. No, thankfully.
So you were really detoxing then?
Yeah. I thought I'd pissed a bed the first night. Oh my God, is that what this is now? But I was sweating.
Wow.
Just sweating out everything.
Yeah.
And my brain was crying out, and my brain slowed down. I had about 4 months afterwards where I thought I'd done really bad damage to my brain.
Wow.
And I was real scared.
Yeah.
Really, really scared. And even now, my memory is not quite what it was. My synapses, my ability to think is quicker than ever.
Yeah.
But my memory is, I meet a lot of people, like my wife, for the first time again.
Yeah.
So sometimes people will go, hey, man, it's good to see you. And they go, oh, have we met? And they're like, we did a whole week of gigs together. And I'm like, okay, good to see you. Stop drinking.
Yeah, I think that's amazing that you have come through this journey and you can talk about it. So thank you, because I think, as I said, talking about stuff helps people to normalize things and to know that, you know, we've all had these things happen to us. It might be different, it might be the same, but it helps to, for people to navigate, I guess. And
I think a lot, especially with addiction, an important thing for people to know is that some people are just heavy drinkers.
Mm.
Not everyone's an addict. I'm an addict because of the way my brain, and I had that checked. I went through the Narcotics Anonymous program, which is government sponsored in New Zealand. I'm sure there's a Western Australia version of that.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But if you are ever concerned about whatever you think an addiction might be or whatever's going on in your head, you can go to the doctor.
Yeah.
I think that's really important for people to hear, because sometimes I think they're wasting someone's time or they're going to be a burden to someone. But you can go and check in. If you're waking up every morning after drinking and you feel like crap, then you can go to the doctor and say that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, get help. Help yourself and do what's right for yourself.
It's no different to if you had a sprained calf muscle and you went to the physio. That's how I view it.
Yeah. Very true. James, we're coming up to an end, so can I ask you, where can people find you on your socials?
At James Nukise on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. And if you go to, I think, my Twitter or my Instagram, it's got a link to Eating Fried Chicken in the Shower. And if you're in WA, I pop up at many comedy clubs around here, because I have nothing else to do with my time. That's why it's been so lovely to talk to you. I'll usually put up whatever gigs I am on those socials.
Yeah, fantastic. And your podcast is really good, and I do, especially if you are a man, go listen to it, because I had to listen and I thought it was fantastic. So thank you for the work you're doing, and thank you for the journey that you've shared as well.
Hey, thanks, Yvonne. Thanks for just providing the opportunity to come and talk to you about this. I don't normally talk to this with just anyone, because I think that's something else we don't talk about with mental health. It's good to have spaces.
Yes, definitely.
This kind of talk can really kill the mood at dinner.
Yeah, yeah. It's probably not an over the dinner table. Depending on who you're with, right?
Absolutely. Sometimes it is. Sometimes,
yeah.
What's on people's minds. But but sometimes it's good to just catch up with someone and shoot the breeze.
James, how do you spell your last name? Because I know that I've struggled pronouncing it, so people will want to find you on socials. So
it's Nukise. It's a Samoan last name, and it's spelled N for nobody, O for oat milk, K for kill. Ooh, that's not good. I for igloo, S for sugar, and E for egg. Because if you have a New Zealander on your podcast, you have to say the word egg.
Egg.
Just have some egg spanks.
So Nukise.
Nukise. Yeah. Nokise.
Thank you, James, so much for joining me today. And thanks for everyone for listening. You've been listening to Yvonne Fletcher and James Nukise.